All right, we're still playing musical chairs, but it's our official time, 1:45, so we'll carry on. I'm James Peterson. Should caregivers risk their lives for their patients? It's just part of care provision that there's always some risk. We use universal precautions. If you have a surgeon who's dealing directly with the patient's blood, the phlebotomist who's drawing blood, all different variations and levels of risk, but we try to make that as minimal as possible. But when we face the next epidemic, sometimes this becomes a dramatic case of having to decide about how much risk one is willing to bear. And epidemics, we don't know what the next one's going to be. Just take a look at flu vaccines. It's very hard to know. But that there will be another major epidemic is the historic pattern and to be expected. It tends to just be a matter of time. And these days, with jet air travel especially, if it occurs in one part of the world, it's very quickly and potentially a global epidemic. So let's think together a bit while there's time to think. I'll give the example of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. For those of you who remember the story, it's certainly vivid to me. I very much lived through this in Toronto. In November of 2002, recognized cases began in China. Carlo Urbani, an infectious disease expert for WHO, was the first to gather samples and within 2 weeks was dead. Initial signs were a fever over 100 degrees and labored breathing. The first patient in Toronto was diagnosed initially at Scarborough Grace Hospital as having severe pneumonia. 28 staff members at SGH were infected with a fatality rate of about 11%. Etiology and transmission were unknown. So, do you show up for your next shift at Scarborough Grace Hospital? When I ask that question with second-year medical students at Virginia Tech or in continuing medical education with professional staff, this generates some discussion. This is a very real question. Well, as it turned out, most people did show up for their assigned staff and shift position, but there were some who did not. Those who did said a number of different things. I'm just giving you kind of a quick survey of some of the thinking that went on. Some said that they had a unique ability to help, and so had a duty to rescue. If not them, then who? They were in a unique position to be of service. People needed their help, and so they had a duty to intervene. Some, when they articulated it, said that the community had invested in their training. There was that first patient who let them do a needle stick. There was that first patient who let them do gallbladder surgery. That they'd gone through a lengthy process of preparation where people from the community allowed them to prepare for this career. And so now the community could expect reciprocity. The community had helped them as much as they pay in tuition, there's much more to it, to get to that point of medical service, and they had some obligation to return when they were needed. Some said that they were keeping a promise to use the skills and position entrusted to them to defend the community. That if you're going to be called a fireman and receive training as a fireman and live at the firehouse, you have an obligation then when there's a fire to show up, even at significant personal risk. That there's a promise involved in taking on that particular position. Some appealed to the golden rule that we find in multiple religions and in a number of different philosophies, that you should help those as much as you would want to be helped if you were in a similar situation. And in the Christian tradition, we often describe this as love of neighbor. When Jesus says you should love your neighbor as yourself, he doesn't say more than yourself. He sets a very high standard, as much as yourself. Other people count as much as you do. And if you would want to be helped in this situation, there's an obligation for you to intervene if you're able to. And then this particular case I'm giving you is in Canada, where there's an expectation of a positive right to medical care. So that it's not just a negative right to non-interference. You can get medical care if you can afford it and get someone to provide it. The expectation in that community is that medical care is a positive right. And if it's a positive right, that means somebody has an obligation to provide it for you. So the medical care community and establishment has an obligation to provide that medical care that you have a right to as a citizen. Well, post-haste, the CDC invented a conclusive test to verify if indeed SARS was present. And with an August group like this, I should ask, was there anybody here in the room who was part of that CDC team? I'd just like to say thank you. I mean, this was desperately needed, a way to verify. The CDC invented a conclusive test extremely quickly, literally in less than a week, which is amazing. It became clear then that the transmission was highly contagious by aerosol, particularly in its end stages, when those infected were likely to be hospitalized. The response, now that we had a better understanding of who had it and how it was spread, was well-fitting N95 respirators and extreme care when removing gloves and masks. That seemed to be effective prevention, also, of course, negative pressure rooms. If the, as far as the patient was concerned, what we looked for was antipyretics, keep the fever down, oxygen if they were not getting enough air, and mechanical ventilation as needed. So now we had a clear way to know what it was, where it was coming from, how it was being spread, and some ways to deal with that. Now, once we knew that, do you show up for your shift? Is that enough to change your mind? Is the risk getting to the point where that's a consideration? And remember, I'm not painting people who didn't show up as automatically villains. I mean, we had care providers who were the sole provider for three children, preschool at home. We had people who had other obligations too, and they're trying to weigh and think through what's the right response. Now, the second phase was there was, of course, a concern that there might eventually not be enough mechanical ventilators for people that needed them, all right? So who have succumbed to the disease and they need the mechanical ventilation until they can recover. So what could be done if there weren't enough mechanical ventilators? So this triggered a very heartfelt and immediately applicable conversation. The general consensus, and not universal, but the general consensus was that the first and best response would, of course, be to increase the supply of available ventilators to serve everyone who could benefit from one. So if you didn't have enough in Toronto, could you send in some by plane from Edmonton or Vancouver or from across the border in Chicago or Minneapolis? Could you gather more ventilators? If there's not enough pie to go around, can you increase the size of the pie? It's certainly an ideal response if you can do it. But if that's not enough could be flown in or actually provided, and again, you're actually in a situation where there were a number of hospitals in Toronto that were closed because they couldn't take anyone in without the risk of more people coming down with the condition. There was concern that the numbers could explosively grow very quickly. So could you have enough mechanical ventilators? Maybe not. If not enough could be provided, the second step would be triaging the respirators to those who had a chance of benefit. This would be a threshold judgment, not a sliding scale. The idea was not, you need it more than this person. The question was, would you benefit from having the mechanical ventilation? You might have somebody who is close enough to death for other reasons that even with excellent mechanical ventilation, their life is likely to end within the next week or two. You don't give them the respirator when you have somebody else who has a full life ahead of them. So there was a threshold judgment. And the emphasis was that withdrawal would be possible lest there be too much withholding. In other words, if you're concerned that once you start a respirator, you can't take it back, then there are people who might have benefited that never get the chance to use it. You want to be able to withdraw if it's no longer benefiting the patient. So that distinction was made as well. The third step would be to provide the mechanical ventilation to those who had been risking their lives to fight the epidemic. All right, so that this wasn't necessarily medical staff, this could be an undertaker who was trained to and involved to remove a corpse in such a way that it would not spread the infection, but a risky process of being so intimately involved with someone who had died from the disease. So this standard is for those who are most directly involved in fighting the epidemic would have first priority for access to the equipment. Utilitarian reasoning for that was that you might be able to return some people to the fight that are needed to fight the epidemic, that have skills or knowledge, that you want to get them back into service. And also to simply encourage staff to show up in the first place, that there was real concern that under these conditions, there might be a substantial number of needed staff members who wouldn't show up at all. But if they knew that the community would provide the best available medical care if they were sickened by helping, they'd be more likely to show up to help in the first place. This was also argued on the idea of reciprocity, that if you're risking your life for the community should do the best it can to provide for you. The fourth step was to prioritize classes of people in the greatest danger. What group of people was at greatest risk during the Spanish flu epidemic during World War I? You realize Spanish flu during World War I killed more people than those who died in battle. Who was at greatest risk? I bet somebody here would know. Yeah, the people at greatest risk were healthy people in their 20s. Probably from a cytokine cascade. But there was an immune response that most of the people who died of Spanish flu were people who were otherwise healthy and in their 20s. Now, if you find there's a pattern of certain groups are at greatest risk, those would be the ones who would need the quickest intervention and help. Then, to all as reachable, not by race, monetary bid, education level, friendship, political connections, citizenship, all those other human approaches you might expect. So that was the general consensus of if there were not enough mechanical ventilators, that line of reflection would disperse the ones that were available. So I realized that I have gone very quickly surveying the situation and giving a whole series of reasonings that were taking place. And if you want to reflect on this in more detail, here are some examples of current articles that have addressed this area. What would be most helpful to you? What would you like to go back to and ask about or comment on? Yes, Ruth.
I don't know too much about this. Don't remember the SARS.
Okay.
What I remember is Ebola.
Yes, that would be the most recent one.
And there were a couple of things that caught me there. One was nurses who just went back, came out, got better, went back anyway.
Yes.
Because I should. And the other was the masses of plastic and rubber that had to be used to keep everybody safe.
Ah, okay. Okay, so the primary way of stopping Ebola was by barrier methods. So you had tremendous mounds of various kinds of filters and covers and protections to try to keep from spreading the disease, that's true. And then the use of disinfectants. So lots of spraying down and isolation. And your question or comment on that?
Generate so much trash.
Ah, okay, so an ecological concern.
Yeah.
Well, we should come up with all the ways to protect the environment that we can. It's such an extreme situation, like with Ebola. Have some people developed more ecologically sound barrier methods? That's a fair question. There's probably a market there. The problem being that it's pretty assured that we're going to face another epidemic, but they come in different shapes and sizes. So for SARS, it was the N95 respirator that was crucial. For Ebola, it was more physical, like rubber and plastic barriers. So it's hard to stock the right thing in the right amount to minimize how much trash you produce. But yeah, that's true. A lot of trash was generated, very much so. Yes, sir. Oh, excuse me. No, I'm looking into a bright light. I was pointing to you. Yes.
Sorry. It's Lynn Yettis from Mass University.
Ah, yes, of course.
Lynn. I actually lived through this. I was a healthcare provider at the time.
Ah, okay.
And so my two observations would be that, and I also taught ethics within my public health sciences. So my observation would be it's quite complicated to be given a case study as a what if.
Mm-hmm.
As perhaps this situation is for many people in the room, it's quite another to have been a live jury.
Yes.
And having to cope with the management of healthcare providers and their safety and their fears and the speed at which everything moved very quickly at the time, both in terms of the, I hate to use the word fear, but the anxiety of the situation, but the pace at which the healthcare system and the public health system moved to move things along to try and come up with solutions, which was impressive. Mm-hmm. My first thing is it's quite a different thing to hear you say this as someone who lived through it. It's really quite brings back a lot of memories. The second thing I would say is that the role of the medical officer of health for Toronto, Dr. Sheila Mazur, I believe it was phenomenal, and her capacity. So it's just observations I would make. Her capacity to address the public and give effective information. And so I would say that's an important component when you're in one of these situations is confidence in those who are giving the information and comprehensive information that is effectively digested by a wide range of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, accurate information that's available quickly becomes crucial because it affects so many people and just the general fear and concern, and do you empty out the city, which then spreads the people that are afflicted. I mean, there are so many ramifications for the community as a whole, as well as for healthcare providers.
Right, I worked in home care, so
okay.
These people were being sent home, that was a concern.
Wow, okay. Thank you, Lynn, that's very helpful. Yes.
I was just thinking that this kind of thing, well, if everybody just runs away, it's not going to stop it, is it?
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose we just sort of have to face it, don't we?
Yeah, we certainly do. The problem is you have individuals who then decide if they're going to run away or if they're going to face it. And what are their motivations to be willing to risk their lives in that case? But it's going to run away if everybody tries to run away from it. That's
yeah,
true.
Yeah, it will come looking for you.
Yeah, yeah. So much at stake. Yes, sir.
I'm Paul Carr. In the 1300s, about a third of our population died from the plague, and then the Native Americans lost like 80% of their population to the European diseases. Mm-hmm. Isn't there a good chance that that could happen again? Because we have a lot of bacteria now that are evolving that antibiotics can't touch. How about the possibility of losing 30% of our population?
Yeah, that's why we invest so much into places like the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, that we do have lines of defense. Is it possible that something could occur that gets past all of our current knowledge and defenses? Boy, I sure hope not. But it has happened many times before, and that's why we do need to be prepared, think while there's time to think, and have processes in place. Remember I gave you the example with SARS. People recognized pretty early on that there was a new disease that was substantially lethal in China. And who was there investigating what the disease was, what's its cause? They didn't have a good handle on it before it had spread to Toronto, but because that foundation was laid, they were able to do more quickly at that point. So there are things put into place. Could they be overwhelmed at some point someday? That's a worst case, terrible scenario, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Sure, Mark.
Mark Sprint. I was in China doing epidemiology research at the time of SARS.
Really?
Okay. Yes. And the Chinese government had been on a 20-year trend toward the privatization of healthcare. After this event, they realized that having bankrupt their public health system, this was the result.
Okay.
And they were hardly humiliated by what had happened, which started healthcare reform in China to rebuild their public health infrastructure because they were so embarrassed that they didn't have the capacity to identify the problem early, you know, put in place preventive measures, quarantine. It took to getting to Toronto, and they were embarrassed by that. So I think a good lesson learned was we're learning about the importance of public health investments.
Yes. No, point well taken. Sure, then.
Jim, you mentioned that most of the people came back to work. What happened to the ones who did not? Did they give reasons? Were they ostracized later? Do you have any information on that?
No, that's a fair observation. The general attitude was that because it was such an unusual situation and it's such an extreme situation, I mean, matter of life and death, most hospitals took the attitude of asking professionals to volunteer. It was almost treated as hazardous duty, and so you would volunteer to show up. And there were enough people who were willing to that there wasn't the need to censure or punish those who did not. Although there were certainly medical directors and others who said, as long as we can staff with the people who show up, we'll work with the volunteers, but that they would start firing people if there weren't enough people to man and to do what needed to be done. And it didn't get to that point, but there were people discussing that was the plan if it got to that point. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I heard of Dave Saunders, retired in Raleigh. I heard a word mentioned a couple of questioners back, the word quarantine. We don't do it much anymore except when certain politicians like to quarantine healthcare workers who return from Ebola countries. But, quarantining was once pretty common. I had a great uncle who I think had to spend two weeks on Vancouver Island in the first decade of the 20th century. Somebody on the ship had fallen sick. So everybody in the boat was put off, and they were quarantined for 2 weeks. And it seems like it's a step that most people would be up in arms about and say, you're violating my civil rights, and so on. So, it seems to me to be a realistic, at least scientifically.
Yeah, much easier to do in the military, as the example you give, where there's a command structure that tells you where to go when. Harder to do with civilian population, but legal to do, and is available if necessary. You can say.
Yeah. So, might want to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think during that time, China took some extreme measures because they weren't ready. Remember, I believe that the first thing they did was to quarantine the country. Right, they shut down everything for like a week, 10 days, something
martial
like that.
Martial law for 6 to 8 weeks.
6 to 8 weeks, yeah. This way, you just let the disease burn itself out, and only when you can have a centralized government with a very strong arm can you get away with that. And the second thing too, very strong arm. The second thing is, if you ever see like resumes from people from China during the period, there'd be like a year or two where they spent studying SARS, and that was a government mandate. You know, if you knew biology or medical profession, right, you worked in SARS for 2 years. And that was it. You know, no ifs or buts. And so the person could be a plant biologist, and all of a sudden there'd be like 2 years of SARS service. You don't understand why. But that was the reasoning.
And it resulted in a SARS vaccine.
Yeah.
You say so?
Yeah, I mean, just with respect to all these past comments and going back to the Ebola situation, one thing that's really important is that the public health professionals who know what to do are listened to by the government. I don't know how many people here remember that at the time of the Ebola infection, one of our political parties decided the solution would be to prevent all entry to the U.S. from Africa. Thank God that did not go through, because that would have been incredibly counterproductive. And instead, the military, the medical military, and the administration, who knew what they were doing, voted that down. If something like that happens again, doesn't occur, and we do something stupid like a ban on travel, the disease will spread uncontrollably. So I think one of the lessons learned from some of these epidemics is trust the people who understand epidemiology and how diseases spread. Don't listen to the politicians who spread the fear.
Well, in order to effectively respond, we have to get some sort of a conversation and cooperation between the experts who understand and the politicians who can mobilize, the police, the legal system, communications. We've got to talk with each other and figure out the best way to proceed. That's quite true. I realize that we have interlocking sessions, and this is 2:10, officially the end of this session. But has anybody seen Lauren Martin? Oh, it did come. Okay. So we do have 5 minutes for Lauren to set up, and we'll have our next presentation at that point. Thank you.